Breakfast at Sally's, written by Richard Lemieux. Chapter 7, Sanctuary at the Hospital. My mother hugged me once again and then sighed. "What do you say you and I have some lunch?" she asked. "Yeah," I replied, like the child that I was. My world changed that day on that swing. I didn't know how much at the time. It was only now, here with Marcia, that I was just beginning to take it all in. I focused all my attention back to Marcia just as she reached the final branch of her tree. "And this is our little Angelie," she said. "She was born just 5 months ago, our 12th grandbaby. Isn't she pretty?"
"That is one fine family."
"Big, huh?"
she asked as she closed her wallet. "Yes, big," I replied.
"For a while we did it, you know, like rabbits,"
she laughed, tossing her head back in the chair. I returned to the sofa and sat down. We were both quiet for a moment.
"They can't do anything more for me here," she said. "I feel sorry for the doctors who have tried so hard. I'm going to be a guinea pig now at Fred Hutch. They have new experimental drugs they want to try on me. More powerful, they say." She paused. "I am ready to die, I think. I am ready to go soon. God has been good to me, and when I die, I guess I'm going to be homeless too, at least until Jesus comes and gets me and takes me to his home."
She was quiet then. I was quiet too. I didn't know what to say. Her right hand went to her neck, and her fingers clasped the cross that lay there.
"The hardest part is telling my Vaughn," she said. "He loves me so much and will miss me so. It is going to be hard for him."
I finally found my voice. "I admire you, Marcia," I said. "I admire that. With all your pain and facing death, you have the combination of strength and grace to think of somebody else." I thought I saw her wince in pain, but she seemed to collect herself again to fight off whatever agony she was in. She shifted in her hair and looked at me. She was smiling.
"Are you okay?"
I asked. "Oh, yes," she replied. "It's just that mean cancer reminding me that it's still inside me."
I paused a moment. "That's a beautiful cross you're wearing," I commented.
"And," she twinkled, "how about the wearer of the necklace? Is she not beautiful?"
I laughed. "Radiant, glorious, beauty nearly indescribable."
"Oh, you must be a poet or a writer with such words," she beamed. "It's good my Vaughn is not here to hear you. He might be jealous."
And she giggled. We both breathed in the now relaxed silence between us. Then Marcia pointed at the television and laughed.
"Look at that."
America's Funniest Home Videos was on. A young couple, she in her wedding dress and he in his tux, had just put the knife on the tall wedding cake when it proceeded to collapse and cascade to the floor.
"And here is the best man that may have partied too much the night before the wedding," the show's MC said as he showed a film clip of a man standing behind the groom at the altar, fainting and falling to the floor. We both laughed.
"And I guess these two damsels really want to get hitched," the MC continued, as the screen showed two women crashing into each other as they raced to catch the bride's bouquet, both of them ending up on the floor. It was in that moment, when my guard was down, that I heard a voice behind the sofa. "Are you visiting someone here, sir?" I turned to see a big man dressed all in black, with a huge protruding stomach and a gleaming silver badge that said "Security" pinned to his chest.
"He's visiting me," Marcia jumped right in. "He's my best friend."
"Okay, sorry to bother you," the guard said. He turned and walked away. "Thank you, Marcia," I said. She just smiled.
"You know, I'm getting a little hungry. Are you hungry?"
she asked. "A little," I replied. I was famished.
"Richard, would you be kind enough to walk down to the cafe and get me a cheeseburger and fries? I would be happy to treat you as well."
"Well, sure," I responded.
I can hardly turn down an offer like that." She held out a $20 bill and said, "Get whatever you like. Oh, and get me a big Pepsi, too, please."
"Yes, ma'am," I replied cheerfully, heading off on the cafe run. As I set out to procure our dinner, I thought how lucky I was to meet a lady who was so kind and gracious. Here was a woman facing death, and she wanted to help a stranger in the waiting room. Once our order had been filled and I had paid for our dinner, I gathered everything up and slowly walked back to the waiting area, trying not to spill the drinks. As I got closer, Marcia was laughing at me.
"You look like a high wire walker juggling that tray," she said.
I grinned and set the tray on the coffee table. I opened her box and placed it on her lap. "When you need a sip of Pepsi, just ask and I'll hand it to you," I said, sitting down and plowing into my own box.
"I'm not supposed to eat this either," Marcia continued, "but I'm going to. Please don't tell on me."
It didn't take me long to eat most of the burger. I saved a piece of the meat for Willow, setting it aside on the napkin.
"What's that for?" she asked.
"It's for my dog," I said. "She's in the van in the garage, and she loves hamburger."
"What's her name?"
Marcia asked. "Willow," I replied. "Willow, like the tree. She is a little white dog, my best friend." Then Marcia took the top bun from her burger and pulled off a big piece of meat.
"Here, give this to her, too."
She held it out toward me. I gratefully received her offering and added it to Willow's dinner stash. "Oh, my goodness, I forgot to give you back your change." I reached into my pocket and pulled out the $6 in change that I had left.
"Please keep it," Marcia said. "You earned it getting the sandwich for me."
"Are you sure?" I asked, holding out the money.
"Would you pass me that Pepsi?"
Marcia said, ignoring my question. I put the money back in my pocket and handed her the drink. She sipped her soda and looked toward the window.
"Oh, here comes my darling Vaughn now," she said, nodding toward the entrance. "Marcia's husband was walking up to the automatic glass door. Richard, would you take this food and my drink away?"
She quickly reached for her purse and pulled out lipstick and a small mirror. She applied the lipstick with a well-practiced hand and adjusted her headscarf. Vaughn broke into a beatific smile as he rounded the corner of the room and saw his treasured partner. He came straight to her side and bent to receive a kiss. "Hello, sweetie."
"Hello, my darling," Marcia said.
"Sorry to be so late, but they kept me over again," he apologized.
"That's okay, honey," she reassured him. "My friend Richard has been keeping me company."
She nodded and smiled in my direction. Vaughn took a step in my direction and extended his hand. I stood up and extended mine in return.
"Nice to meet you, Richard," he said, "and thanks for keeping my Marcia company."
"It was my pleasure," I replied. Then Vaughn turned to Marcia and softly asked in his native Tagalog,
"Anog seen a big doctor?"
Marcia clasped her hands in her lap as she replied,
"Puminta sa ibang hospital, Fred Hutchinson in Seattle."
Vaughn's shoulders slumped. He bit his lips and his eyes watered as he looked to the floor. I didn't understand the language, but I could tell he had asked his wife what the doctor had said, and she told him she was going to Seattle. Marcia then unclasped her hands and reached out to Vaughn. Her husband gladly held them.
"Pero okay lang ako," she said, smiling.
Vaughn squeezed her hands tightly and then smiled back. I knew she had reassured him that she was going to be okay. Then she glanced toward me.
"Richard was telling me Fred Hutchinson is a great place. Right, Richard?"
"I've heard it's among the best in the world," I replied. Marcia continued,
"The doctor said they have experimental drugs that could kill the cancer. Then we can take that vacation to Guam this fall."
"Good," Vaughn said, putting his hand on his wife's shoulders. "Whatever we have to do, we will do."
"It is now 8 o'clock and visiting hours are over," bellowed the intercom.
Marcia turned to me again and said,
"Richard, I will be praying for you."
"And I will pray for you," I said. I watched as Vaughn pushed his darling Marcia down the hall toward the elevator. I knew I would never see her again. I had the waiting room to myself with Marcia and Vaughn gone. The Swan was on TV. A woman named Becky was getting her nose broken and reshaped, and she planned to have her tummy tucked and her breasts resculpted. I thought to myself she would never be as beautiful as Marcia, and I got up to change the channel. I crouched down to press the tuner button on the Magnavox. The next scene I saw was Donald Trump calling a group into his boardroom so he could fire someone. I pushed the button again. People were eating dead bugs of some kind from a bowl, trying not to throw up. I pushed the button again. PBS had a program on gorillas in captivity. Finally, something civilized. I returned to the sofa. The narrator was explaining how Snowflake, the only white gorilla ever discovered, was captured and sold to a zoo in Barcelona, Spain, where he was placed in a barren enclosure with no trees for shade and no other gorillas for company. The big hospital security guard passed through the room. "How's your friend?" he asked, looking at me. "Having a tough time," I replied. "They're sending her to Fred Hutch tomorrow." "Well, if you need to stay, I can get you a blanket," he offered. "No, that's okay, but thanks," I responded. The guard walked off, and I was relieved to know that I had more time of sanctuary on the sofa. As soon as he left, two women and a man came down the hall that led to the elevators. One woman was crying, and the other woman had her arms around her shoulders. They walked slowly to the back of the room. "He's going to be okay," I heard one woman saying. "He's a strong man, and he has a lot to live for." I could hear them talking in hushed voices in the background as I watched the gorillas on TV. The man walked to the side of the sofa where I was sitting and looked briefly at the TV. He had his cell phone in his right hand. We exchanged brief hellos, and he dialed a number on his phone. "Hello, Marion. Marion, can you hear me?" he asked, then paced off. "Yeah, we are still at the hospital. We're going to be here a while. So please put the kids to bed at 10. Don't let them talk you into any later. We'll be home as soon as we can. Okay. Thanks. Bye." He closed his phone and walked toward the women. I heard one ask, "Ron, do you think it would be possible for you to go over to my dad's house later and feed Shorty?" Ron assured her that he would do that. "Dad always takes him for a walk around the block when it's not raining. But if it's raining, he just takes Shorty out to the front yard so he can go potty." "Don't worry," Ron responded. "I'll do that in a little while." I was near tears as Snowflake, now a massive, full-grown, powerful gorilla, was playing with one of the babies he had fathered. He leaned over the gorilla, gently pulling on one arm, and then playfully pushed it from side to side. The baby wrapped its arm around Snowflake's neck and swung into his arms. Snowflake gracefully put the baby down on the ground and rolled it over on the stomach. A car pulling into the circular drive caught my attention. A man got out. I could tell by the exhaust fumes coming from the back of the car that he left the motor running. He was well-dressed in pressed khaki pants, tasseled black and brown loafers, a white dress shirt, and a red power tie. He talked on his cell phone as he walked briskly into the waiting room, but finished his call as he approached the small group in the waiting area. "Well, what's up?" he asked.
"He's in the ICU, Martin," one of the women said in a trembling voice. "He's stable now. He had a major attack. He fell down the stairs and cut his head, but he was able to crawl to a phone and call 911.
Then she broke into tears. It was quiet again for a few seconds, except for her crying. "Well, I had a house closing at 5, a city council meeting at 7, and I'm already late for an 8 o'clock staff meeting back at the office." His cell phone rang again. He checked the number before answering. "Martin here," he said. "Yeah, I'm running late. My dad had a heart attack and I'm at the hospital now. I'll be there in 10 minutes. He put the phone back in his pocket.
"Can't you stay a little bit longer, Martin?"
the tearful woman asked. "No, I can't," he said. "I don't have the time. If he hadn't smoked all those cigarettes, he wouldn't be here now. And I'll bet he doesn't have enough insurance to cover all this, and I'm going to get stuck with the bill."
"For God's sakes, Martin, he's your father," the woman flashed back.
"He's 72 years old, Martin snapped, and his phone rang again.
Hey, I've got to go, he said, checking the number on the new caller. Call me if anything happens, he called over his shoulder, rushing back to his car.
I hate my brother,
the woman said coldly. Why don't you sit down, Nancy, the man suggested. I needed to go to the bathroom. I picked up the AA pin to drop at the reception desk and then headed down the hall. I passed the elevator Marcia and Vaughn had taken to go back to their room. I saw a small sign marked Chapel just across from the men's room. I peeked in. It was a small, dimly lit room with an altar and a cross stationed in the middle. A large Bible was placed on the stand next to it. The book was closed, but a piece of paper was sticking out of the pages. I moved forward and opened the Bible, taking the note out and reading it. Dear Lord, I ask you to take this pain away from me, or please take me in my sleep this night. The burden has become too great, and I pray for your peace. Please send your angels to carry me away. As I put the note back, I noticed it had been placed right beside Psalm 23, a psalm of David. I began reading, The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He maketh me to lie down in the green pastures. He leadeth me beside the still waters. He restoreth my soul. He leadeth me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me. Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. I put the note back in between the pages and closed the book. I backed away from the book and the altar and sat down in a chair in the front row of the chapel. Since my night on the Tacoma Narrows Bridge, I simply didn't believe in God anymore. I felt sad for those believers who expected some help and relief from some invisible Holy One for whom they could only leave notes. Maybe their God was online by now, with an email address, a modem, a ThinkPad, and a server. I laughed. I laughed at God as I sat there looking at the cross in his big book. The irony was that I had nothing to live for except Willow. I had no family to care for me and nothing to hope for. I wanted to die and could not, but Marcia wanted to live, had so much to live for, but the cancer was slowly, painfully ravaging her body. And then there was my mother. She was a believer too, and she died of cancer. Her God let her suffer and die in agony when she was not yet 60 years old. As I sat there, the anger at their God began to well up in me until I began to shake. I wondered if I might strike a deal with their God. I would be an agent, a broker, a deal maker. It would be a simple trade, my worthless stock for Marcia. So I got slowly down on my knees and began to pray. Dear God, this is Richard. Do you remember me? You are the God my mother and father believed in so deeply. Remember them? They are the ones who had their baby daughter kidnapped when she was just 7 months old in Chicago. They never saw their child again. They were the ones whom the police came to tell that their son had drowned in the Chicago River when he was 12. And their next child, another daughter, died from diabetes when she was 13. I am offering you a simple deal tonight. Upstairs in this hospital is a woman named Marcia who is dying of cancer. She is a wonderful person who wants to live for her husband, children, and grandchildren. How's this for a deal? You take me instead of Marcia and cure her cancer. I waited for a moment and then slowly got to my feet. I sat down in the front row of the tiny chapel. My mind drank in the silence of the room. Then it began constructing ways to consider the moment. Was this to be my new life? Meeting others briefly, looking at their pictures, sharing their secrets, peering in the windows of their lives, overhearing tearful conversations of those overcome with fear and worry? Had some devils, spirits, or ghosts been given my soul after my failed suicide attempt? Were they toying with me like Scrooge, parading me around for their enjoyment in some fourth dimension? Then I recalled a character my father used to draw over and over again on scrap paper. It was a cat,
facing away from the viewer on the picket fence with its tail hanging down. Sometimes he would make the ears round, other times pointed. Sometimes the tail would be curled at the tip. I learned as a child that he drew that cat often whenever he was tired. He called it the observer. When I would ask what it was, he would always say the same thing. It's a cat, son, a cat sitting on a picket fence, just watching the world pass by. My father's observer was always facing away from him, looking out at the world. Was it just watching the world go by? Or was it waiting for something? It was time to take Willow for a walk. I could feel her calling me. I stood up, walked out of the chapel, down the hall, and through the big automatic doors at the entrance to the hospital. The rain had slowed to a cold drizzle. I got Willow out of the van and took her for a brief walk near the bushes beside the garage. I gave her the hamburger Marcia had given me for her, and she gobbled it down. When we climbed back into the van, I moved the clothes around to make room for our sleeping bag, and we nestled in, pulling the top of the bag over our heads so the security guard couldn't see us. We were a little damp, but it could have been much worse. As we snuggled down, I told Willow about Marcia and her 7 children and 12 grandchildren and about Marcia's cancer. Then I thought of all the family pictures I had once had of my mother, my father, and my own children. I had left them behind over 8 months ago in a storage unit in a nearby town. When I couldn't pay the bill, those pictures were undoubtedly thrown in a dumpster and my last valuable possessions auctioned off to the highest bidder. And I remembered the last time I saw my mother. It was in a hospital. She had colon cancer. She'd had an operation months before, but, like Marcia's, the cancer had come back. My father called and asked that I stop in at the hospital on the way to work because my mom wanted to talk to me. She's in room 202, he'd said. I remembered pulling into the parking lot of the single-story Mercy Hospital in my hometown of Urbana. I pulled one of the front doors open and walked into the lobby. There was no television or sofa and no coffee shop. I walked down the hall to room 202 and peeked in. It was a small room, no TV. Just a picture of Jesus on the wall above my mother's small bed. Dad was there too, sitting on the side of the bed, talking softly. My mother smiled at me as I entered the room. "Hi, honey," she said, reaching out her hand to me. My father stood up. I could see the worry and fear in his eyes. Then he sat down again. I could tell she was in pain. "How are you feeling, Mom?" I asked. "Oh, not so good today," she said. I pulled a small metal chair closer to the bed and sat down where I could hold her hand. "What are you doing tonight?" "Oh, I'm supposed to cover a high school basketball game in the city," I said. "2 pretty good teams, but I don't have to be there until 7, and I can stay longer if you need me." Then my mother did what she always had done for me. She protected me, even from the sadness of her own passing. "Oh, I'm going to be okay," she smiled, with as much brightness as she could muster. "I'll be going home in a day or two. How is my grandson, Richie?"
"He's fine, Mom," I replied, returning her smile. "You know what he did this morning? While I was up in the bedroom making the bed, he got into the kitchen pantry and found the empty Pepsi bottles. Well, each one probably had a little sip left in it. And he was sitting on the floor with 6 pop bottles trying to get that last little bit out of them." My mother laughed. We talked for about an hour or so before a silence came.
"Well, you'd better get back to work, huh?" she finally asked.
"Yeah, I guess," I replied, looking at my watch. I stood up and leaned over the bed again and gave her another kiss. She reached out and clasped my hand, squeezing it tenderly. "I'll see you tomorrow," I said, and I walked out the door. It was just about 11 p.m. when I was sitting at my Underwood, putting the finishing touches on the story of the basketball game I had covered. One of the other reporters called out, "Richard, line 3 for you." I picked up the receiver and pushed the blinking button. "Lemieux," I said. "Richard," my father's voice said, "your mother passed away just a little while ago." Silence filled the air.
I didn't know what to say. Finally, the simplest of words came. "I'm sorry, Dad," I said. "I wish I could have been there." "You know your mom," he replied. "She wanted it this way." I knew he was right. She would rather have had me off playing sports writer than sitting beside her, watching her die, sharing her pain. Her name was Grace, and she lived up to it. "Well, I'm going home in a little bit to feed the dog and go to bed," my father said. "Why don't you stop by the house in the morning, okay?" "Okay, I'll see you in the morning." I hung up the phone. I didn't cry that night, or later, at the funeral. And I didn't cry when my father died 10 years later. Now, here, sleeping in the back of my van in the parking garage of a hospital in Bremerton, tears welled up in my eyes for Marcia, for my mother, and for the brothers and sisters I never got to know. I felt the presence of my sweet mother saying, "Don't cry, Richard. There is nothing to cry about."
You've been hearing Breakfast at Sally's by Richard Lemieux. Copyright 2009. It is read with the permission of Skyhorse Publishing of New York. Join us next time on the bookshelf for Breakfast at Sally's. The bookshelf is produced and edited by Vern Windham. I'm Jeff Hazen.